Welcome to Think Like an Owner, a show exploring how the most ambitious CEOs grow great companies. I'm your host, Alex Bridgman. Each week, I dive into the strategies and tactics that build transformative businesses with the operators doing it firsthand. You can learn more about the guests and the companies they are building by visiting us at tlaopodcast.com. There, you will also find our weekly newsletter that further analyzes how companies are finding success today. Lastly, if you enjoy Think Like an Owner, please share this podcast with a peer and leave us a review. My guest today is Henry Schuck, founder and CEO of ZoomInfo, one of the most successful data businesses in recent times, with a market cap today around $12 billion. I've been looking forward to this podcast for a really long time because Henry has proven to be an effective founder, acquirer, and public CEO capital allocator, which is a rare combination of skills to find in a single CEO. He's thought very deeply about building high-performing organizations, sales functions, and how his own role needs to evolve as the company grows. We talk through lessons learned building versus acquiring capabilities, M&A and integration lessons learned, fixing problems with a process versus culture approach, and how data businesses will succeed in the future. Please enjoy this fantastic conversation with Henry Schuck. Every CEO and entrepreneur needs support from a team of expert professionals like attorneys, bankers, and accountants like Hood & Strong. Less often mentioned, but just as important, is insurance. And August Felker and his team at Oberly Risk Strategies are the experts you need on your team to navigate the insurance needs of your company, as dozens of past podcast guests have partnered with them to do. Oberly helps you evaluate what your current and soon-to-be acquired company needs for insurance today, while also anticipating what it will need tomorrow. To get in touch, email August at august.felker@oberly-risk.com or visit their website at oberly-risk.com. And now for some advice and observations on insurance for small companies, here's August himself to share his expertise on today's Q&A. Can I just roll the insurance from the company I just acquired into my ownership of that business?
That's a great question. So one of the questions we get from our clients a lot is, you know, hey, can't we just take the existing insurance that's there and just keep it through the ownership transition? And the answer really is not typically. First off, insurance is not assignable. So the insurance carriers insure the current business, want to make sure they know the owners of that current business, what that current business does. So they don't allow for the insurance program to automatically be assigned to another entity. And that would be the case if it was an asset deal. So in an asset deal, 9.9 times out of 10, the insurance carriers will require a brand new insurance program to be created. And so that's something to really think about and know and get started on ahead of time. In a stock deal where the FEIN stays the same throughout the ownership transition, a lot of the insurance carriers still have protection because they want to make sure they know who that new owner is and are uncomfortable about just continuing to insure someone through an ownership transition. So they have like these change in control clauses where if there is a change in ownership, they have the right to cancel the policies. So those are two big things to look out for as you're buying a business, is to get started early because more times than not, the insurance is going to need to be rewritten.
Great. Thank you, August. To learn more about Oberly Risk Strategies, please reach out to August directly at august.felker@oberly-risk.com and visit their website at oberly-risk.com. I also want to thank our other sponsors, Hood & Strong and Ravix Group, for supporting the show. And now to the episode. I'm an aviation geek as well, beyond just data. And of course, all of the Boeing stuff right now is pretty wild. And you know, I don't know, I'm sure you enjoy your ZoomInfo job, but the CEO is leaving at the end of the year. So if you're looking on the job market yourself.
I'm very unqualified for that role, unfortunately.
You seem to run a pretty good company, pretty well-run business. What were some of the things you'd focus on or look at if you were running Boeing?
Look, I don't know enough about the issues at Boeing, but I'm certain that, okay, I won't say I'm certain, I'm relatively certain that it's a culture, there's a culture issue. Look, some problems, this is a learning I've had over the last 2 years, some problems you can solve with process, where you show up and you go like, oh, we did this thing poorly last time. So now let's build a process around it to make sure like nothing ever falls through the cracks again. But some problems cannot be solved by process. And if you try to solve too many problems by process, you just end up with like all this crazy process crap, basically. And that's because a lot of problems need to be solved by culture and not by process. So I'll give you an example. I got super upset, I don't know, a year ago, because people would post something on Twitter or they'd post something on LinkedIn. They'd be upset with us about something, or they're trying to get support and they weren't getting it. And inevitably, I was the one responding. I would see it. I would respond to it. I'd be like, hey, no problem. I got you connected to support. This thing's going to get fixed. And I went internally and I told the team, like, hey, it's kind of BS that it's just me responding to like upset customers out there. And they're like, okay, no problem. We're going to create a process. We're going to create this like rotating list of people who have to check Twitter and LinkedIn every 30 minutes, Monday through Friday. And then Friday and through Sunday, we're going to create a rotating shift. It's like, that's not how you fix this. Like, this is a culture problem. Like, a product manager should care what people are saying about Zoom Info online, because that affects the work that they do. And the leadership in content and the people who own Twitter or whatever, the people on social, they should feel like owners of this business and feel a responsibility to check. I'm not asking them to ruin their weekend. 9 out of 10 times, nothing is on Twitter. Just when you go on Twitter on the weekend, put Zoom Info in the thing and see if there are pissed off people you can respond to. Like, that's, and care about it. And you could build process and process and process, but that process is going to break down because someone's going to be at a wedding or in a movie or whatever. And what you'd want to create is actually culture that cares to solve that problem, not more and more process to solve that problem. And so my sense is that you could go into Boeing and do one of two things. You could go, okay, we're going to add lots of process to make sure doors never come off the plane again. You know, we're going to do this process and that process and 62 other checklists, as if the checklists that exist already were not enough. We're going to add a whole bunch of additional process. I don't think that solves Boeing's problem. I think you have to solve the problem with culture.
How have you seen other CEOs and peers of yours solve that kind of culture versus process problem?
You know, my CEO friends want to solve problems with culture. They also happen to be like founder CEOs, so they're very comfortable solving problems with culture. And I'm not trying to say that there's no place for process. There is. But process is also a very comfortable place for people to go to in corporate America. When I come at you and I go, hey, there's a problem, I need this fixed, it's very comfortable to go, got it. This is how I'm going to fix it. Process, 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 process. I talked to 50 people. Here's what they said we should do. And I build this whole process. It's a much more comfortable place to be than to try to solve it with culture. Because culture requires you to be slightly inspirational. It requires you to lay out principles that are important to you and your team. It requires you to manage to those principles and make sure that everybody in your team believes in and drives to those principles. You know, we have a bunch of corporate values, and I wrote them originally in 2015. Like, I remember where I was. I was going through an airport, and I got super frustrated that, like, every time we rolled out a change at the company, people would be like, oh, another thing, another change. This is like, oh, you guys are always just changing stuff. And I was like, listen, changing stuff is actually part of our culture. That is who we are. We're going to constantly experiment things, and we're going to get things wrong. And when we get things wrong, we're going to change. Like, that's who we are. And I realized, like, okay, I need to codify that into like a document that we're going to change fast. We're going to change a lot of things. We're constantly optimizing that and a whole bunch of other values that I want people to know Zoom Info stands for. And I wrote it. 2015, shared it with everybody. In 2023, I went back and read it, and it was like, oh, like 8 years, this thing got watered down. Like, every time a new head of employee value branding showed up or some new person in content showed up, they took this thing that was like specific and created ideals, and they took a little bit off the edge and then a little bit more off the edge and a little bit more off the edge. To at the end, it just reads like every other company's culture and values and principles. And I started doing these roundtables with our employees. I was like, hey, do you know our values? What are our cultural values? And nobody knows any of them. They only know one, which is get 1% better every day. They all know that one. Somehow that one stuck. It's memorable. It's like, but none of the other ones. And so I rewrote them. And so today there are five: be entrepreneurs, be innovators, be a team, be relentless, be experts. And every time I talk to somebody or go into a situation that I don't think is living up to those ideals, I will tell people, like, this is not us being relentless. This is not us being entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs take risk and they move fast. This is just like 10 months of process to do something an entrepreneur would do in 3 weeks. This is not us being entrepreneurs. This is not us being innovators. Like, this is not us being relentless. And then I went around and said, okay, cultural values and principles, they're fine. They're important. And it's great that I've like outlined them in a way that people can, I think, is more authentic. But people also don't know what be relentless sounds like or looks like at the company. And they don't know what being an entrepreneur sounds like or looks like in the company. And so then I went through and I gave everybody a bunch of examples of what be relentless looks like and what be an expert looks like and what it sounds like. And I told people, like, if you were blind and you came to Zoom Info, what would you hear that you would know, like, oh, this is a company that takes being an expert and being an entrepreneur as a serious principle? And then we wrote those down for our employees. And I want people to go, like, this is who we are. You come to Zoom Info, you give me more of your waking hours than just about anything else in your life. Almost certainly more than everything else in your life. More than you give your family, more than you give your friends, more than you give yourself. And you should understand who we are as a company. Like, you're on the team. What do we stand for? And so I want people to know what those things are, because they can either align to them or go, like, that's not really me. I'm not relentless. I'm not an entrepreneur. Great. There's like lots of companies where that's not a cultural principle. They don't even want it. Like, Boeing doesn't want it. Entrepreneurs and big risk takers. And they probably don't want innovators, you know, like, they want something different, safe, risk averse. That's great. It's not us. But if that's you, you shouldn't come to Zoom Info. And making sure people understand those things helps us get the right group of people who are aligned culturally to do the work.
Is that also a hiring filter, finding people who fit those values? Like, I'm trying to think of like a company of, you know, Zoom Info's size, like that's an easier culture to maintain when you're really small and it's just you and your friend in the dorm room, or maybe, you know, half dozen people. But beyond like a, you know, sharing of values and repeating yourself a lot, how else does that happen? How else do you create that culture?
Look, first, Alex, I'll tell you, I don't buy into that premise. I don't think it is, you know, I don't think you said impossible, but I don't think it's that hard to scale a business and continue to keep that type of cultural value and principle at the forefront. Have a lot of companies done it? No. And does it get watered down along the way? Yes. It does take you showing up constantly and reminding people that these are the types of people we look for and that we should be screening for those type of people. You know, I think Netflix does a really nice job of this. It's very clear what Netflix's cultural values and principles are. And if you don't meet them, Netflix doesn't want you to be at Netflix, and they'll give you a severance and they'll show you the door. And I think they've done a good job of scaling to, you know, tens of thousands of employees by maintaining that. That doesn't mean you're 100%, but it does mean that it's a central part of how you think about the team that you're putting together. Definitely easier for at 10 people than it is at 3,700. But people have to be reminded that this is a priority in the business and it's important to the business. Otherwise, what happens is that every other pressure in the business to hire overtakes this. And so, yeah, I know that these things should be screens, but I need to hire 30 people, 30 account executives in the next 3 months. If I adhere to this principle, I won't be able to hire 30. I'll only be able to hire 10. And the business needs to be okay with 10 people who align to those principles, and you take a little bit longer to go find the other 20. Like, hiring right, the first thing you have to agree to, or the first like mental model you have to agree to if you want to make sure you hire really well, is that you have to agree that it's going to take longer than what you would like. And then you have to be really disciplined around spending the time to get the right people at your company. And that is where most of this breaks. You're time pressured. Your performance is being pressured by the lack of this person, or you need new people. And then you compromise on those principles, and you end up getting less than really great people in, or really culturally aligned people into your business. I do this thing twice a year where I get together with a group of founder CEOs, and we spend like a Thursday through Sunday, and all we do is talk about like our businesses, what's going well, what's not going well. Everybody has like a unique superpower. So everybody's just trying to like yank that superpower out of the other person. One of them's really great at product design. One of them is really great at compensation philosophy. Someone's good at go-to-market. So everyone's just trying to like steal that superpower from the person around them. But our first meeting, I asked everybody like, hey, if you went around your company and you interviewed everybody, what percentage of them would you rehire? Like with unlimited time, what percentage of your staff would you actually rehire? And the answers were like between like 30 and 60%. And you went like, man, if that's true, isn't it the biggest problem in all of our businesses? Isn't it the number one issue we should be focused on? The fact that we wouldn't rehire, 60%, 50% of the people who work at our companies. We talked about different ways that you could do that. Everybody went back like super inspired to, I wrote cultural principles, everybody went off and did their thing. I don't know how it's going now, but it is like I think at every company, every founder CEO, every CEO, if they ask themselves that question, they answer it really honestly, I think puts a big spotlight on what has to be the biggest issue in your business. It is just a people business.
Yeah. What are effective ways to address that? Or like, what do you take away from that? What would an effective, perfectly performing CEO do with that information?
I think you would go and you'd, number one, make sure that all of your talent acquisition professionals know how to screen for that. What are the things, would know exactly what you're looking for in all of your roles. And you would set up a structure that gives you a longer period of time to hire and do some better planning so you're never like in a crunch. So you have the right pipeline of people and the right amount of time to hire the right people. You would go to every hiring manager and you would say, hey, these are critical screens that we need to do on every employee that we hire at ZoomInfo. And I want to know how you're going to adhere to it. How are you going to test for it? Here's how we do it in sales, how we test for it in sales. Here's how we test for it in engineering. You need to figure out how you test for it in content and marketing and product management. And you would force people to live by that construct. That's the only way I think you can do it. Coinbase, I just read this article about Coinbase. Coinbase today, this isn't a small company too. I think Coinbase like 5,000 employees or something like that. Today, every hire has to be approved by the COO and CEO. The COO and CEO took over the hiring process and said like, we're looking for these types of people and I'm going to approve every single person we hire. So that's happening today, at a 5,000 employee company. So that's how important it is, or how much people can value it. And it's just a matter of, can you get like your, this is a cult, like, by the way, just for the record, this is a culture process thing, right? Like, Coinbase is going to solve it with process, right? The new process is every one of your hires goes through me. And I think actually the solve is a cultural one, right? Like, make sure everybody understands what it is you're looking for. And then that you've built a culture that also wants to drive that outcome. And then you don't have to approve every single person who comes through the door, but maybe for some period of time, you do it so that you show people what it looks like and how important it is. And then you build the culture around that. But I think that is a culture thing.
So on top of culture, what have you learned about various incentives or processes, perhaps, of getting folks to get behind like being entrepreneurs within ZoomInfo?
Yeah, look, I think it is number one, one of the big things that you were doing. We went from 1,100 employees in June of 2020 to like 3,700 in June of 2023. And that means we hired a bunch of people remotely. We hired them in the pandemic. And to keep people like coordinated and aligned, we built like all sorts of process. Like, okay, we're all going to meet every week, no agenda, just going to meet, align. If you want to get something done in product marketing, you need to go talk to your counterpart in marketing, go talk to your counterpart in sales, go do another meeting with the executive team, whatever. It's like seven meetings to get a 15-minute decision done. And so that slows everything down, which is the opposite of being an entrepreneur. And so I've been going through and making sure, number one, that I'm sharing a lot of context about how I'm making decisions, about how I'm thinking about the business with my executive team. And then I'm making sure that they're sharing that context down to their teams so that they're in better positions to make quick decisions without having to go get context from a bunch of people to make those. I think that's one thing. You mentioned incentives. I think like when I think about incentives, like there's obviously like comp incentives, and we use those. We use, you know, primarily you're using that in sales, right? You're going like, you know, whatever your sales target is, your quota is, once you get there, you make more money. I think other places in the business using these types of incentives is less effective because your connection to the impact might be muted. But I think it's less about incentives and more about aligning to who we are as a team and feeling like if everybody feels and believes that they're on a team that upholds these principles and everybody around them are also upholding those, there is a disincentive, right, to bucking that trend. And you don't want to be the only team that's not doing that. So that's how I would answer that.
You've been a founder and now pretty astute M&A executive as well. It's kind of rare to see that in one person, like being an effective founder and get an M&A and large scale businesses. That's a challenging skill set. What have you learned from various investors you've worked with or just other CEOs of being good at each of those things, each of those skill sets?
Yeah, look, I think being good at M&A requires you to be, look, being good at either requires you to be a good capital allocator. That's kind of like, at its most simple, in its most simple place, your job as CEO and founder or all the way through is to be a great capital allocator. You know, I have this much of resources. Where do I allocate those resources to get the most return on that investment, on those resources? And sometimes that is like, hey, I'm going to put these dollars in marketing because I see something good happening in marketing and I want to accelerate it. Sometimes it's, I'm going to take these dollars away from this team because they're not performing. I don't see how they return on the investment. I'm going to go put that over here into something that I do see real return on. And then sometimes it's, I've built this really efficient business and I have an opportunity to acquire a company that's a competitor or an adjacent company, and I can run those businesses far better and more efficiently than they're being run. And if I do that, it creates the optimal outcome for my employees, for my customers, for my shareholders. And I think you're constantly looking, I'm constantly looking at the world through those lenses, or and just those three lenses are kind of the biggest, the main ones. For all decisions, for all issues that I find in the company, I am looking at that through a lens of the customer, through the lens of my employees, and then through the lens of my investors and shareholders. And I'm trying to make the best decisions with those inputs. Throughout the growth of ZoomInfo, sometimes that was building new product organically. Sometimes that was acquiring adjacent products or competitive products. Sometimes that was driving sales and marketing for the products that we have. And so it's really trying to figure out where your capital is most effectively allocated. And I think if you're doing, like today, for example, I'm not doing a lot of M&A today. The bar is high. I think valuations in the private market are still like dislocated compared to the public market. And so you know what I think the best company to buy is? ZoomInfo. And so we're doing share buybacks right now. And so we're allocating capital back to buying what we believe to be the best priced, best company on the market. And so we're allocating capital that way right now and less towards an M&A lens. Now, that doesn't mean that's going to be the case forever. There might be a big transformative acquisition that we want to do, and we should allocate capital that way instead. And so these things, like, they change over time based on what's going on in your business, based on where you see growth opportunities, based on where you see green shoots in the business that maybe you want to accelerate. You might accelerate that by putting more of your P&L dollars into that part of the business. You might accelerate that by doing an acquisition that would speed up that part of the business. And so these are all just like, how can you be a great capital allocator? There's a great book called The Outsiders. Have you read it?
I have, yeah. Big fan. Yeah.
It does a good job of basically laying out this principle.
Yeah. Can you dive into that kind of matrix of build, license, acquire, or partner with some new tool or functionality or product that you're hoping to incorporate into ZoomInfo? You've kind of done a little bit of all four, it seems.
Yeah, yeah. Wait, what were the build, license, acquire, partner? Yep.
Yeah. So build yourself, license it from someone else, buy the business, or find some sort of partnership.
Yeah. So let's talk about licensing. Licensing is, or licensing or partnering with our, which are often, they might be synonymous in a lot of ways. Sometimes there's something experimental, and I don't really know if it's going to be like adopted by all of my customers. I don't have strong conviction for it, but I do think it's interesting. In those situations, I want to license or partner, and I want to test it out. If I'm licensing or partnering, do I see an incredible lift? Do I see an ability to sell it across my customer base? And if I do, then the question becomes like, do I want to build or do I want to buy that? So I'll give you an example. We bought a company in 2021 called Ringlead. Ringlead was a partner of ours. It's a data management technology that helped us, from a partner perspective, helped us land a whole bunch of enterprise accounts. And so when we showed up to our enterprise customers, they were saying, listen, we love ZoomInfo, but we actually need help like doing like deduplication and cleansing of our data and using ZoomInfo's data to do that. But then we need like rules and structures to maintain the data going forward. And we don't really want to just buy all your data if we can't actually do that. It's like, okay, great. Ringlead will help you do that. Let us bring our partner into this conversation. We'll have the conversation with you. They go, okay, yep, now I can see that. Unlocks an enterprise sale, unlocks an enterprise sale, unlocks an enterprise sale. And so we said, okay, this is a great partner. It's helping us unlock enterprise sales. If we had this as an asset, it fits with what our customers are trying to do with ZoomInfo. We want to expand the enterprise. We think our biggest opportunity is within our enterprise customers. And this helps us grease the skids on the way in to all of our enterprise customers. Why shouldn't we own this product? And then so we acquired Ringlead to help us do that. There are other places where I actually think like partnering around an ecosystem is actually the better structure. So today we're launching in the middle of the year our Copilot product, which is an AI-driven Copilot for salespeople. And one of the things that's a key input into that copilot are signals. Signals that tell you what's happening at an account, signals that tell you this is the right time to reach out to and engage with an account. Those signals, they can come from a lot of places that we own. So for example, we own a great intent data product. So it can come from that. We know when we're tracking 300 million business professionals. So we know when they're moving jobs. They might have been your customer at their last company and then they just left. You need to know that. That's a great signal. We have this great IP to company graph. So we can tell you, we can de-anonymize at the company level visitors to your website. Great. That's super valuable. It's a great signal. We own that signal. And then a number of other signals we own. Then there are a whole bunch of signals that we don't own and we don't think we should own, that we want to partner with. And so we want a data ecosystem, a signal ecosystem, essentially that somebody could come into and say, hey, we sell signal on when oil and gas companies are going to start a new rig. I don't know. I'm just making it up. And I don't need to own that signal. Oil and gas, you know, people who sell to oil and gas are just going to be a small segment of my customer base, but I want them to get the best signal possible. I need a partnership motion that plugs them into an ecosystem that takes advantage of that signal downstream. And so those are areas where I think it makes a lot of sense to partner, and having an ecosystem to partner makes a lot of sense. When it comes to other M&A, like the best type of M&A also needs to be looked at from a go-to-market through a, you know, you're looking at it through a number of lenses, the two most important being go-to-market and product, or product and engineering. And so the go-to-market lens, in the best acquisition you can do, you acquire a product that you can sell to your entire customer base, has applicability throughout your customer base, and is not so complex, is not a particularly different sale than what you're already doing within your customer base, what you're already selling. If it's too technical, too complicated, sells to a different buyer, all of those are like knocks on the go-to-market side. You want a product that you can sell to all of your customers and the buyer is the same. That's the best possible M&A, and that the integration is fairly simple and straightforward. If you can get those two things, you can see a lot of growth synergy in bringing the companies together. That's the like, that's where you start. Go to market. Can I sell this to my entire customer base? Can my existing sellers with some enablement sell it to the customer base? Like, or do I have to bring in an overlay or have SEs or, you know, all of that? And then can I implement and service it in the same way I'm implementing and servicing my core product? Or do I have to hire different people, different implementation consultants, a different delivery mechanism? So in a perfect acquisition, those things line up and then those are the knocks on it. Then on the product side, can I integrate it quickly? Can I migrate it quickly? So they're, you know, most often they have existing customers. So can I migrate them to a single platform relatively quickly? And we've done that as fast as a year and a half, the full migration, and as long as 4 years for a full migration, but the faster the better. So is the integration easy? Is the migration easy? I think those are from the product and engineering side. Do they use the same languages that we use, or was it built in something weird that needs to be completely rebuilt? So you're kind of thinking through that piece as well.
You've integrated a lot of acquisitions over your time and in different ways too. Rain King seemed like a, you know, a big downsizing. ZoomInfo is continuing the momentum that they had. What have you learned about integrating companies underneath one tech platform, one set of, you know, values, one employee base? How do you view integration into, you know, a single business through ZoomInfo?
Yeah, look, I think if you put two similar companies together, it's oftentimes you're faced with decisions of you have duplicative roles. And so if we have an overlapping customer base, I don't need two reps on SAP. I need one. And so how does my employee base shake up after I put the two companies together is an important thing to think through. if you're doing M&A right, you are finding things in the acquired company that they're doing better than you. When we acquired ZoomInfo, they were way more efficient at marketing and they were much further along from a technology and engineering perspective than we were. Great. Like, that means the CTO of ZoomInfo should become the CTO of the combined company, and the CMO at ZoomInfo should become the CMO of the combined company. They're doing something better than us. Like, it's more efficient, generates more, it's faster, whatever the criteria are. That's super interesting because what inevitably happens is the company that did the acquisition, like in the ZoomInfo acquisition, we were DiscoverOrg, we acquired ZoomInfo, but then the CTO of ZoomInfo became the CTO of the combined company and the CMO of ZoomInfo became the CMO of the full company. And so then I had a bunch of employees who were like, what the heck? Like, we're the acquirer. Why? It's like, what is happening? It's like, look, we're putting the very best possible team we can put together, and I'm going to make decisions that evaluate who's doing something better, faster, more efficiently, and then those people are going to run the combined business. And that means in some places, DiscoverOrg has a much better go-to-market motion. We're going to take over that. And in some places, ZoomInfo has a better engineering motion. They're going to take over that. And so communicating that to your teams is super important. We're building the best team. It's not like a conquest because we have like more to do after that acquisition. And then sometimes there's duplicative roles and you have to make tough decisions around those too.
It sounds like you'd make these decisions really quickly and often have a good plan put together before you close. How do you get to that conviction before all the papers are signed?
So you are meeting... You're meeting the executive teams. You are understanding, like in sales, you're looking at numbers. You're looking at how people are performing. There are some places where, you know, you don't need two CFOs. So that's always like a fairly easy one. You don't need two CMOs. And so you have access to a bunch of data during M&A that'll help you make those decisions. And then you can ask to meet people on the team before the deal closes to see if to gain or lose conviction in your perspective. Look, and then I think the best advice there is once you've made the decision, you have to communicate it immediately on day one, in my opinion. I think the worst thing you can do is show up. Obviously, the first day, everybody's going to go like, are there going to be layoffs? Are you firing people? Is my job in jeopardy? And if you can't be really clear about that answer, you slow down the opportunity in front of you because everybody's going to be nervous. Everybody's going to be like talking about who they think is on the chopping block or not on the chopping block, or just creates this really crappy culture. And you have an opportunity up front to have your decisions made and show up and say, listen, there are a subsection of folks who are going to know in the next 24 hours that we're eliminating those positions. And they didn't do anything to deserve that, right? Like, they didn't like do something bad. It's just that the acquisition forced this decision. I get that they're your friends and that you've worked with them and that they're great people. Know that we're going to give them a severance. We're going to give them healthcare benefits. We're going to help them find a new job. And we're really going to be good by your former colleagues. And then we're done. That's it. Go back to work. Like, don't go to work worried about whether you're next. Once this is done in 24 hours, we're done. That's the team. We're going forward after that. And I think that level of clarity is really important.
What other skills around M&A are you focused on improving for yourself now, like today? Like in the next 2 years, what do you want to be better at?
I think the biggest thing is being, you know, one of the things that I got wrong is when, you know, we ran primarily like a data platform and then we went out and made a number of software acquisitions and they're great software companies. And we were so convinced that the way that we ran onboarding, implementation, customer success, account management was like so amazingly good because we had done these other data acquisitions and we took their less efficient motions and turn them into our very efficient motions. We're convinced that you could just take that model and plug it in everywhere. Well, it turns out software businesses are much more complicated because they are necessitating behavioral change. Whereas our core business is like, hey, you're doing prospecting every day, right? You're in your CRM every day, right? I'm just going to make that way better for you, way easier for you. You don't have to change any behavior, really. All you have to do is instead of like going and using crappy data to do your job, we're going to give you really great data to do your job. And we're going to rank the accounts and it's going to be like a much better experience for a thing that you're already doing. For most software businesses, it's a little bit less like that and a lot more like, I need you to change this behavior. And every day I need you to do this other thing a little bit differently, or I need you to like change your workflow to this new workflow. In that deployment, that implementation, the customer success behind that is a lot less efficient than when you're just plugging into an already existing flow of work and making it better. And so one of my learnings is delivery, implementation, those things differ from software platform to software platform. And you have to really understand what you're trying to get the end user and customer to do and how much change is built into that. Otherwise, you can get the model really wrong. And I've gotten that wrong.
How do you think data companies in the future are going to succeed, like both in the ZoomInfo context, but across data companies that you look at or hear about? What do you think is going to work in the future?
I think unique proprietary data assets will continue to be really valuable and will continue to be really valuable and protected. And I think I'll give you an example. Not all data companies can say that, because what a lot of data companies have done is they've taken a pretty generic data asset and then through like fundamentally like people energy, like in offshore people energy, they've tagged what was a generic data asset in a unique way. And so in a generic data asset, let's say I just have 100 million companies and it's just generic. It's like company name, company description, maybe the industry. That's like an okay data asset to do some stuff. Where it becomes valuable is if I can tag it in a way where like a niche market can get value out of it, especially if that niche market is like pretty big. And then I could sell it into that use case. So let's say private equity firms, venture capital firms, they want to find like the next 20 most likely to be successful HR technology vendors, software HR tech vendors. Today in ZoomInfo, you could do it, but it's probably not fully tagged the way that you would want it to be tagged. And so there are companies that have gone out and they've done really specific tagging around this. And that data asset, while super valuable in a non-generative AI LLM world, becomes like way less valuable in a generative AI LLM world, because you can take that generic data asset and then you can just tell the LLM, go find me the HR tech companies across this. And if you've ingested a whole bunch of information, you don't have to have it be structured. It could be really unstructured. And the LLM can go pick up and do the tagging for you across millions and millions of records that wasn't available before. And so I think if you're a data company that's collected a unique data asset, that you're in a protected space. But if you've taken a generic asset and done some tagging or categorization on top of it that was valuable in a non-generative AI world, those things I think you're going to see under pressure.
Henry, thank you so much for coming on Think Like an Owner. Really appreciate getting to meet you and chat with you a little bit more. Thank you for sharing your time.
My pleasure, Alex. Best podcast I've ever been on.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Think Like an Owner. If you enjoyed the show, please consider leaving us a review and telling a friend to help more folks find Think Like an Owner. I also want to thank our show's sponsors, Hood & Strong, Oberly Risk Strategies, and Ravix Group for supporting the podcast. For full episode transcripts and our weekly newsletter, please visit our website at dlaopodcast.com.